You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
The story of David and Bathsheba evokes a powerful response within a lot of us. Naked lust, adultery, cover-up, and murder. It's great soap opera material, which is also fun to follow in the biblical text, where different authors over the ages then try to either ignore David's behavior or use it to discredit him. According to the text, David sends out Joab, one of his generals, to fight the enemy du jour. And by the way, Joab also happens to be David's nephew. After all, what's a little nepotism on top of everything else, right? Note that David has risen to such prominence that instead of leading his own troops, he's back at home in Jerusalem, leisurely ignoring the fighting going on in his name and taking a late afternoon nap. He wakes up for a stroll along the walls of his palace when he sees this attractive woman bathing. Why she was immodestly bathing within sight of David's daily walk is a topic for another sermon, but despite having at least 6 wives and 10 concubines, David pursues her, she becomes pregnant, and well, you'll hear the rest. In one fell swoop, David had broken at least 3 of the 10 commandments: do not covet, do not commit adultery, and do not murder. But I don't want to talk about any of those. As you listen, be thinking about the human condition that gets someone like David or us to the point where this kind of behavior happens in the first place.
Our words of wisdom today are from 2 Samuel chapter 11, verses 2 through 17 and verse 27. One late afternoon, David got up from taking his nap and was strolling in the roof of the palace. From his vantage point on the roof, he saw a woman bathing. The woman was stunningly beautiful. David sent to ask about her and was told,
"Isn't this Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam and wife of Uriah the Hittite?"
David sent his agents to get her. After she arrived, he went to bed with her. This occurred during the time of purification following her period. Then she returned home. Before long, she realized she was pregnant. Later, she sent word to David, "I'm pregnant." David then got in touch with Joab.
"Send Uriah the Hittite to me."
Joab sent him. When he arrived, David asked him for news from the front, how things were going with Joab and the troops and with the fighting. Then he said to Uriah,
"Go home, have a refreshing bath and a good night's rest."
After Uriah left the palace, an informant of the king was sent after him. But Uriah didn't go home. He slept that night at the palace entrance along with the king's servants. David was told that Uriah had not gone home. He asked Uriah,
"Didn't you just come off a hard trip? So why didn't you go home?"
Uriah replied to David, "The chest is out there with the fighting men of Israel and Judah, in tents. My master Joab and his servants are roughing it out in the fields. So how can I go home and eat and drink and enjoy my wife? On your life, I'll not do it."
"All right," said David, "have it your way. Stay for the day and I'll send you back tomorrow."
So Uriah stayed in Jerusalem the rest of the day. The next day, David invited him to eat and drink with him, and David got him drunk. But in the evening, Uriah again went out and slept with his master's servants. He didn't go home. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it with Uriah. In the letter, he wrote,
"Put Uriah in the front lines where the fighting is the fiercest. Then pull back and leave him exposed so that he's sure to be killed."
So Joab, holding the city under siege, put Uriah in a place where he knew there were fierce enemy fighters. When the city's defenders came out to fight Joab, some of David's soldiers were killed, including Uriah the Hittite. And God was not at all pleased with what David had done. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
In Lewis Smead's book, A Pretty Good Person, he recalls an episode from Mark Twain. Huck Finn sees an accident where an African-American slave is killed. A fine, genteel white lady asks him whether anybody got hurt. "No, ma'am," says Huck. "It just killed an N-word," which relieved the gentle lady considerably. She said, "Oh, well, it's lucky because sometimes people get hurt." Lewis Smeads asks, what's going on here? What's going on is that the lady would not let herself know what she really did know, that black people are people, just like her. Black people talked the way only people can talk. They wept as only people can weep when they sorrow. They loved each other with a love only people can feel. She knew this, but she corrupted her consciousness. She refused to know what she knew. She let her consciousness be corrupted, not her conscience, that inner feeling or voice most of us have that acts as a guide to the rightness or wrongness of her actions, but her consciousness, her situational awareness, her ability to perceive reality for what it really is, rather than how you've been programmed to perceive it. In the case of this genteel Southern woman, her worldview denied reality, yes, but it was also convenient to the maintenance of her privileged, out-of-touch lifestyle. And that's a bargain she was willing to make. That's what we see in our story today, too. Despite his numerous wives and concubines, David's pampered and insulated lifestyle corrupted his consciousness, his awareness of reality, to the point that no one else mattered. He wanted what he wanted when he wanted it, and damn the consequences. And don't bother me with the facts. We do this as individuals, as communities, right? On up to nation states. In Vietnam, over 58,000 Americans were killed, 300,000 wounded, and uncounted South Asian lives snuffed out or altered forever. Over $150 billion were spent, which seems like nothing anymore. In the Academy Award-winning documentary Fog of War, Secretary of State Robert McNamara admitted it was all a mistake. He said, "We saw it as part of the Cold War when it was, in fact, a civil war." He actively discouraged President Johnson from being honest with Americans because, quote, "their response would not be compatible with having furthered the war," unquote. Their consciousness was corrupted. Fast forward, and we still have a fair number of Americans who believe that we attacked Iraq because Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. When we think about all the lives lost on both sides and all the money squandered, it makes you want to weep. But some people's consciousness has been so corrupted that there's no convincing them to change their mind. With Iran, a nuclear deal, and diplomatic relations with Cuba still unresolved political hot potatoes, I hear people claiming, "You can't trust the Iranians. You can't trust the Cubans. They're fundamentally evil. They hate us for no reason, and they're tricking us." But if your consciousness wasn't corrupted, you'd know that if anyone has reason to distrust, it's the Iranians and the Cubans. During the Cold War, our CIA overthrew Iran's democratically elected government and installed a puppet dictator so we could steal their oil. The Shah's bungling then led directly to the militant Islamic takeover of the country with which we're still dealing. And Cuba? We invaded them. We tried to assassinate their dictator on multiple occasions and any number of other unneighborly behaviors, but somehow they're the bad ones? Paul Tillich, one of the major influences in my theological thinking, was a notorious philanderer. After he died, his widow published a book with all of the details. Did no one at the seminary know? One of his colleagues said, "We all knew, but we refused to know that we knew." Refused to know that we knew. Now that's some corrupt consciousness. You know, I seldom get up in the morning and think, "Hey, I'm going to lie to myself today." But in reality, self-deception in one form or another is an everyday practice for all of us. We deny what we know and then deny that we know we're denying what we know. Don't interrupt me with the facts. How? Maybe reality is in some way unbearable for us. Pain, unfairness, unfulfillment. Better to just ignore it. As Carl Jung said, there is no coming to consciousness without pain. And I don't know about you, but I don't like pain. Ask white South Africans in the late 1980s why they pushed so hard to resist a change in the apartheid system. And if they're honest, they'll say fear. They were conscious of what needed to happen, but they worked really hard to not know it. I'd like to think that if I'd lived in the 1850s in the United States, that I would have been on the side of those seeking to end slavery. But who knows? A lot depends on whether I'd been born in the North or the South to privilege or struggle, to an interpretation of scripture that said slavery was an abomination, or God ordained. Even now, the question of immigration reform goes to people's sense of their right of birth. This is mine, and you can't have it. You're not welcome. Never mind that we're sitting on land that has been contested for 1,000 years between Native American tribes, then the Spanish, then Mexico, and only recently, American settlers. But maybe most of all, we fall into the trap David fell into. Our passions or privileges corrupt our consciousness. They blind us to what we should know if we just paid attention. In the story of David and Bathsheba, we get distracted by the infidelity, the cover-up, the murder. But what this is really about is one's privileges blinding us to what we're owed in life, what we think is fair. David was drowning in unexamined privilege. It led him from laziness to covetousness to adultery to lying and eventually murder. In the clarity that the recent Me Too movement brings to the way some men treat women, David's actions approach the Weinsteinian. Mind you, later in the story, David does get his comeuppance, but it takes the prophet Nathan calling him out of his fog to realize just how despicable he's behaved. So, if we don't have a Nathan in our lives to shake us out of our complacency, how do we become more conscious of reality and break through all the forces at work corrupting our perception of reality? Like any effective recovery program, the first step is acknowledging that you have a problem.
I have a problem?
Yeah, you do.
Well, what do I do about it?
Try and be more aware of the world around you and how your actions affect the lives and circumstances every person you meet.
Sounds like a lot of work.
Well, start small.
How small?
Like wearing a mask small. It's sad that wearing a mask has become so politicized, but just do it. Someone whose consciousness is uncorrupted by conspiracy theories and trumped-up patriotism can embrace the science and simply do the right thing. Wearing a mask is about putting love first, because reality says it can cut down on the spread of the virus.
But some people won't like it.
Yep. And some people don't like the suggestion that our Black, LGBTQ, and Muslim neighbors deserve dignity and respect either. But that's not going to stop you from putting love first, is it?
No.
Okay, now, think about a time when new information caused you to change your point of view or your behavior. For many of us, the 21-day racial equity habit-building challenge was a big dose of new information about the reality of systemic racism in our country. The series offered an avalanche of information that broke down people's corrupt ideas and gave them a clear picture of what it's like to live as a minority in the U.S. Or when you realize that the church teaching that Jesus is the only way casually condemns billions of other people to an eternity of excruciating torture in the fires of what some people think is a literal hell. It justifies anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim groups and actions. And Christians kind of just shrug their shoulders and say, hey, I don't make the rules. All I can say is that's some corrupt consciousness. And it's just that kind of disconnect from the reality of the modern world that has caused a lot of people to just give up on church. For me, when I learned that Walmart won't let its employees bargain collectively and pays many of its workers such low wages that some of them qualify for food stamps, which means my tax dollars are helping subsidize Walmart's bottom line, I decided to stop, if I could help it at all, shopping at Walmart. It stopped being about trying to save money and started being about using my actions to leverage change in the world.
So you're basically talking about consciousness raising.
Well, yeah. But also the realization that the world naturally resists consciousness raising, often violently. Why? Because it usually means change. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, the United States crossed over a significant threshold this summer. As of the middle of 2020, the majority of children in the United States are now non-white ethnic minorities. That means that by sometime in the 2040s, the United States will officially become a majority-minority country. And guess who knows that better than most? White supremacists. Is it any wonder that their ranks have been growing exponentially in the last 10 years? They see the change barreling toward them, and they're scared. Their corrupted consciousness believes that the United States has been and shall always be white and Protestant. And any person or group that threatens that birthright and sense of superiority is an enemy and un-American. And obviously, no discussion of corrupted consciousness would be complete without a mention of how awash our country is in crazed conspiracy theories like QAnon right now, where assertions of secret cabals of deep state operatives overlap with baseless claims of celebrities and politicians being Satan-worshipping pedophile cannibals. What to do? First off, you're unlikely to change the perspective of anyone who's gone down that rabbit hole. So don't bother trying. what you can do is continue to work on your own consciousness. Out-of-control conspiracy groups count on convincing their adherents that they are fundamentally good and that there's some evil coordinating power out there someplace that they have to resist. But what we know as followers of Jesus and people of faith is that the best way to deal with the brokenness of the world is to start with ourselves. We have to open ourselves to a deeper awareness of how our everyday behavior, our everyday privilege, and our everyday beliefs affects the lives of others. It's the only way we will have a chance of avoiding the conspiracy web that the problem is out there somewhere, or the trap that David fell into of being so wrapped up in our own life that we don't give a second thought to harming others for our own benefit. So, whether it has to do with race or religion, sexuality or politics, or where you do your shopping, don't wait for a Nathan to come spell it out for you like he did for David. With the guidance of the Spirit and the companionship and accountability we have with one another, we have it in our own power to face the corruption of our own consciousness head on. Remembering that no problem can be solved from the same level of consciousness that created it. If you want to raise your consciousness to a level that can start to see over the ramparts of corruption and envision the kind of world Jesus would have us aspire to, then you can't go wrong by starting with Jesus' admonition in Matthew 25. Whatever you do to the least of these, you've done unto me. Start there, and the rest will start to fall into place. Look, the reality is that there is pedophilia and human trafficking going on in our country. But because of unhinged conspiracies like QAnon, the helplines, nonprofits, and other organizations that are actually in the trenches fighting these problems have been overwhelmed by baseless accusations and false claims that Tom Hanks and Oprah Winfrey are satanic monsters. QAnon zombies carry signs that say hashtag save the children, but don't actually do anything other than point fingers and tsk, tsk. Meanwhile, real people, real children are suffering because of the corrupted consciousness of these lazy and privileged modern day Davids. Our situational awareness matters. Our consciousness matters. And the behavior that our awareness manifests matters. David messed up big time. His consciousness, his awareness was corrupted. He thought he could do whatever he wanted and not have it come back and bite him in the butt. But it did. Jesus, on the other hand, was all about an uncorrupted consciousness. He was not afraid to point out where religious inertia and social privilege hurt the widow, the orphan, and the immigrant. But his biggest threat to the powers that be was not about pointing to others and whispering about how evil they were. He empowered individuals who were otherwise excluded and disenfranchised to embrace their own worth. He behaved as if women were human beings. Shocking. He made people confront their prejudices about the other. Outrageous. And every time he poked a hole in the corruption of people's status quo consciousness, he made it more likely that their individual behavior changed and in turn moved the world toward change. Don't be like that genteel Southern woman who could casually and callously dismiss the humanity of another person simply because of the color of their skin. Don't be one of those people who refuses to know what we know. Raise your consciousness of the way the world is. Don't be satisfied with the corrupted and compromised awareness of the status quo with which we've all grown comfortable. And when the pushback comes, and it will come, remember that there is no coming to consciousness without pain. The beginning of Tikkun Olam, the healing of the world, depends on the degree to which we are conscious of the ripples that our thoughts, beliefs, and actions in the world, and their effect on the least of these, our brothers and sisters. So, here's to the spirit of life, guiding you and me towards a consciousness uncorrupted by the status quo, leading us to be a part of the healing of the world. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.